Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 50 years ago today, January 8, 1964, in his first State of the Union address, President Lyndon Baines Johnson, LBJ, declared war on poverty.
This administration today, here and now, declares unconditional war on poverty in America.
In the half century since, the United States has spent trillions on the poor. It has also shipped millions of jobs overseas, seen more and more low-wage work, had an epic recession, seen wealth explode at the top, and we still have a lot of poverty. This hour on Point, poverty in America and tackling it, 50 years after LBJ declared his war on poverty. Let's listen to a little more of LBJ, January 8th, 1964, talking about Americans living on the outskirts of hope.
Unfortunately, many Americans live on the outskirts of hope. Some because of their poverty, and some because of their color, and all too many because of both. Our task is to help replace their despair with opportunity.
And then his declaration of war on poverty. It came with kind of ringing emotion from a president who had grown up knowing poverty.
It will not be a short or easy struggle. No single weapon or strategy will suffice. But we shall not rest until that war is won. The richest nation on earth can afford to win it. We cannot afford to lose it.
And here we are, 50 years later. Joining me first today from Princeton, New Jersey, is Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. He has a forthcoming book about the history of LBJ's Great Society and is co-authoring a history of America since the 1970s. Julian Zelizer, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, thanks for having me.
50 years on, what did LBJ intend? Did he know exactly as he stood there on that day before Congress?
Yeah, he wanted to try to diminish the problem of poverty in America, and he wanted to try to help the poor become self-sufficient and give them the tools they needed to enter into the middle class. It was not a radical program. It was a program that ultimately believed individuals needed to be self-sufficient. And finally, it was a program that wasn't going to spend a lot of money to do this. So he knew what he wanted to do, but he was also limited and restrained in his ambitions.
So over the years, then decades, the program rolled out. A lot of money has been spent in 50 years. 50 years is a long time. How would you compare what emerged as the face of America's war on poverty with what LBJ intended?
Well, he didn't eradicate poverty, and if that was part of what he wanted and that was a goal, he didn't achieve that. That said, I think the programs he put together, not just the War on Poverty, which is usually referring to the Economic Opportunity Act, but all the programs he puts into place, Medicaid, Medicare, food stamps, if you take all those programs combined, it's fundamentally changed the experience of poverty. It has created a social safety net. It has lifted many, many millions of Americans out of very dire conditions. And by all those measures, I think even with the failures, he would consider this a pretty big success.
But let me put it to you again. Did the shape of the program, or programs, many of them, that emerged, jibe with what you think LBJ intended or expected when he stood there that day talking about a war on poverty?
Generally, yes. I think there are certain parts that went a different way. He didn't expect that mayors, Democratic mayors in the 1960s, like Mayor Daley, would start to dislike the program because they believe that activists and non-machine people were using the money in ways that they couldn't control. He didn't expect to anger fellow Democrats, but overall, I do think a lot of the program unfolded the way that he hoped. It did create a kind of social safety net which the New Deal had failed to achieve.
Here's President Johnson again on that day talking about the range of fronts upon which war would have to be made.
Very often, a lack of jobs and money is not the cause of poverty, but the symptom. The cause may lie deeper in our failure to give our fellow citizens a fair chance to develop their own capacities, in a lack of education and training, in a lack of medical care and housing, in a lack of decent communities in which to live and bring up their children.
LBJ, 50 years ago today, Julian Zelizer, you're our historian here. Did he think it could really be done? We heard him say that the richest nation on earth can do it and we cannot afford to fail. 50 years on, much has been done, but nobody would say we've won a war on poverty. We've knocked maybe a few percentage points off of poverty in America, but there's still plenty. Did he believe, as far as you know, it could actually be done? I mean, after all, it's in the Bible. Jesus says there will be poor with us always.
He did believe it. I don't think he believed he could totally eradicate poverty, but I think he believed the government was capable of making a pretty big dent. This was a guy who came of age in the 1940s and 50s, who really believed in what the New Deal had done, and who believed that the combination of government and an era then of economic growth, when the economy was very strong, offered the president, offered Congress the tools that were needed to really change how much poverty existed in this country. And obviously some of his rhetoric was overblown. He knew that that's how you sell a program that faced a lot of opposition. But I do think he had very high ambitions in terms of what he could achieve.
Julian Zelizer, we want more historical perspective as we go through this hour. Please stick with us. I want to welcome in as well now from Washington, Melissa Boteach, Director of the Poverty and Prosperity Program at the Center for American Progress. She coordinates the Half in 10, the campaign to cut poverty in half in 10 years. She's co-author of the new Center for American Progress report, The War on Poverty, Then and Now. You can find it at our website. Melissa, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom.
And with us from Santa Barbara, California, Leo Hanyon, professor of economics, UCLA. Also, he's director of the Ettinger Family Program at the Macroeconomic Research, senior fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. Leo Hanyon, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
Melissa, what have we achieved? Where have we fallen short in 50 years?
One of the things I think it's important to remember is that if you take the safety net into account, a new Columbia University study is showing that the poverty rate actually fell by 10 percentage points between 1967 and today, from 26% to 16%. And the poverty rate would be nearly double what it is today without that social safety net that we put in place. So I think it's important to acknowledge the successes that we've had. However, I don't think anyone says we can pat ourselves on the back when you still have about 47 million Americans living in poverty. And so one of the things we have to acknowledge is that as the country has changed over the past 50 years, our policies haven't always kept up. So we talked a little bit about growing income inequality. The share of income going to the top 1% of Americans has more than doubled since the war on poverty was launched. And at the same time, we now have about 1 in 4 jobs in the United States that does not pay enough to keep a family of 4 above the poverty level. So it's not the war on poverty that's failed. It's our economy that's failed. And what we need to do is to set out a vision for how in the coming years we can improve our labor market and put in place the proper supports to help people access the middle class.
Leo Hanyon, we want to look at new thinking in this hour. I mean, after 50 years, we would hope we have new thinking. But looking at the war on poverty, where do you see success? Where do you see failure?
Yeah, the focus of Johnson's original speech was to allow the poorest Americans to have a chance. I think a quote was developing their own capacities. And the success has been that we've provided a lot of resources for Americans to escape the worst of poverty. We've spent about $21 trillion over the last 50 years. I think where we failed is really on Johnson's intent to allow people to develop their own capacities and to become self-sufficient. I agree that the poorest Americans don't have enough opportunities to get out of the traps of poverty. And there's really two issues. One is that safety nets in some ways have become dependency nets. And the other is we have an economy now that is not very friendly towards individuals, towards workers who are not sufficiently skilled to compete in a job market where they face competition from low-skilled workers from other countries. And perhaps more important, they face competition from increasingly cheap and sophisticated capital goods that are taking the jobs of the poorest and the low-skilled Americans.
Julian, you're our historian here, just a minute before the break, but how do you think LBJ would look around at the landscape of poverty and plenty in this country now?
He would be upset. He'd be upset about the extent of poverty that has continued, but I think he would, too, see this not just a failure of his own programs, but of a failure of government to keep up with changes in the economy and to actually reverse some of the gains from his presidency.
Was he sure that government could keep up, that government could do these jobs? I mean, you said he's a New Deal era guy. We've had some sort of sobering, we've had some big successes and some sobering resetting of expectations of government in these decades.
Absolutely, but he was a believer. He did believe that the government could deal with these problems. Part of it was from what he saw in rural America and how the New Deal had changed areas that he came of age of in Texas and other areas, and he thought those same powers could be transferred to the broader problem of poverty.
And here we are, 50 years later, with so much still, 47 million Americans in poverty, never mind people hanging on to middle-class status and really worried about it. Here he was, 1964, January 8th, talking about Americans who faced setbacks and where they may look for help.
We all can guess from our own lives how difficult they often find their own pursuit of happiness. How many problems each little family has. They look most of all to themselves for their future. But I think that they also look to each of us.
LBJ with kind of Texas tenderness from the podium there 50 years ago, but just last month, here's President Obama speaking at Melissa Boteach's Center for American Progress.
The idea that so many children are born into poverty in the wealthiest nation on earth is heartbreaking enough. But the idea that a child may never be able to escape that poverty because she lacks a decent education or health care or a community that views her future as their own, that should offend all of us. And it should compel us to action. We are a better country than this.
Melissa, I'm looking at these numbers, and I mean, you began to throw them out. I think it can be very confusing because some poverty counts take into account government assistance and some do not. If you take it into account, what, we've gone from a 19% unemployment rate to something like 15%, 15%, 16%. But if you don't take those government benefits into account, I'm looking here at a Columbia University research project that found that they had 25% poverty in 1967 and 31% poverty in, what, 2012. How do you look at those numbers, Melissa?
So I think that what this is showing is that the safety net has made a huge difference in cutting poverty. The Columbia University study that you're referring to showed that if you don't include the safety net, poverty goes up. If you do include it, it drops 10 percentage points from 1967 until today, and that's progress. But at the same time, we're forcing our safety net to work overtime because our policies and institutions have not kept up with economic and social changes that have taken place over the past 50 years. So, for example, in the 1960s, one-fourth of families relied on women as breadwinners. Today, that's two-thirds. Two-thirds of families are relying on mothers' income as breadwinners. But our country has not kept up to this reality. We're the only country in the developed world who doesn't have paid family leave, that doesn't have paid sick days to help families balance breadwinning and caring for children or elderly parents. This is just one example of the ways in which our policies have failed to keep up. So yes, the safety net has worked, and yes, we need to build on what works. But we also need to examine where our country has changed and what we need to do moving forward to catch up.
We've had a lot of Republican and a lot of Democratic presidents and years of dominance in Congress in those 50 years. Here was President Ronald Reagan. His address to the nation on welfare reform, this was August 1987.
More must be done to reduce poverty and dependency, and believe me, nothing is more important than welfare reform. It's now common knowledge that our welfare system has itself become a poverty trap, a creator and reinforcer of dependency.
Okay, Leo Hanyon, we've had Republicans in office, we've had Democrats in office, take away government support, and we've got 31% poverty in this Columbia report. That is not very encouraging, Lee.
No, it's really an abysmal situation, and you know, both a primary problem with some of our programs is not that we are providing assistance. So today, a household of four with around $22,000 of income qualifies as being in poverty. Their consumer spending is around $44,000 per year. So assistance is being provided, but we have programs that have means testing and marriage testing that, in my opinion, are really damaging towards helping people become sufficient and getting out of dependency programs. So in some states, a parent who has two children is unmarried and doesn't work can receive around $35,000 in market value of various types of forms of state and federal aid. And yet if that parent goes off and works in a job paying $30,000 per year, they're actually financially better off because so many programs are means-tested.
Lee, I know that line of argument. And you know, we've had it for many years, and there are very serious disagreements on it, and it's put forward with great seriousness. I know it. But here's the thing. If you want to leave it to the economy, I think a lot of Americans would love that if it would work. But today, I mean, according to this Columbia report, if we did that, we'd have 31% poverty. And if you push those people out into the economy, look at that economy, Lee. You've got so many low-wage jobs out there. It's close to sickening. So where's the answer in that?
Well, the issue is one time that you just brought up, which is I mentioned a single parent earning $35,000 per year. Many of those would not be competitive for a $35,000 per year job. They simply don't have the skills. They don't produce value that would merit them earning those types of salaries. So we now have a situation in which we have poor households becoming poor households generation after generation, individuals not requiring enough schooling and training and what economists call human capital to become competitive and to be able to earn salary that can support a family. And that's where we've really gone south.
I mean, what about LBJ's description, though, Julian Zelizer? And he talked there about people in the outskirts of hope. In this speech, he was not pointing at their personal failings. He was talking about the lack of a decent education or health care or a community that, you know, shares an investment in their future, talking about color. I mean, I have no doubt LBJ expected people to step up and work hard, but he was certainly very aware in his speech, very explicit about the environmental factors in engendering poverty.
LBJ actually went in both directions on this. If you hear his speeches and you hear the private phone conversations, on the one hand, he shared some of the arguments you hear from conservatives today, that part of the problem has to do with the individuals themselves, ranging from their skills to their personal behavior, and you hear that kind of conversation frequently. But on the other hand, he was also very sensitive to environment. So when the riots break out in 1965 and 67, the thing he says to a lot of legislators is that unless you change the environment, unless you provide jobs, unless you provide education, unless you provide hope, people are going to become engaged in these kinds of violent activities. And you have to change the environment to change the lives of those who live in poverty. So he actually said both of these things. That's part of what made him complex. And I think his policies tried to deal with the different aspects of this problem.
I mean, individuals live in economies, they live in environments, they contribute to those at the same time, get thrown out there today, and it can be pretty rough. Here's a little tape. This was in August. The LA Times talked to 36-year-old Talisha Rice, working at a South Los Angeles Burger King. $8 an hour. She'd been there for 6 months as a cashier. Here she talked about living, supporting a family on that wage.
I pay $6.75 for rent, and then I have to pay the utilities. That's like $100-something a month. And then the car insurance, you have to pay for gas. I have to buy food, clothes for me and my kids, everything. So it's not making enough with $8 an hour.
Melissa, there she is, $8 an hour, and it's her fault?
Exactly. That, I mean, we just released a poll, half intended, that put the argument about structural issues in the economy head to head with issues about personal responsibility. And while I think everybody would agree that people should take personal responsibility for themselves, in a forced choice, people understood Talisha's argument. Two-thirds said that the structural issues of the economy are the main thing that's driving increased poverty today. People know there's not enough living wage jobs out there. They know that their incomes are not keeping pace with the cost of living. Childcare has gone up. College tuition to transition to the middle class has gone up. And wages have not kept pace. And I think that people get that.
So, Lee, what are you proposing here? I mean, there seems to be an impulse in some quarters to just kick people out into the economy and assume that they'll swim. But you know what that economy looks like. You know the profile of wage levels out there. Many communities are not giving their young people the education to succeed in that. What are you proposing, Lee?
Well, you know, there's no easy answers. As a society, we need at some level to subsidize low-paying jobs. We need to make it worthwhile for individuals, for businesses to hire low-skill workers, so individuals can build skills and can achieve higher-paying jobs. So programs such as enterprise zones in poor neighborhoods, I think, could be enormously helpful. Provide sufficient enough tax breaks for businesses to go into cities where poverty rates are high and skill levels are low, and make it worth their while to go and hire individuals. Because once someone does get a job, they build skills. They understand what it takes to become a valuable competitive worker. A number of these people simply just haven't worked in years. And when you put somebody into a job, they build a lot of skills, and then down the road they can take on higher paying, they will be worth higher paying jobs. So that's an important factor. And another factor, which is not going to change anything overnight, is that we fundamentally have to improve the quality of American public education. We have now an educational system in which only one-third of our children, irrespective of grade level, only one-third are competitive, are proficient in science and math. And this compares to numbers that are in the 60 and 70 plus percent range in some Asian countries. Our poorest states, such as New Mexico, Louisiana, Alabama, Mississippi, have proficiency rates of only one quarter, which is comparable to Kazakhstan and Croatia, very poor countries that simply don't have the resources to provide public education.
Let me take that point. If I may ask you, do you think that inequality itself, which has grown so dramatically, is part of the problem? Does the concentration or the sort of whoosh up to the top of a whole lot of income and wealth create poverty at the bottom?
We have poverty at the bottom because 50 years ago when Johnson started this program, if you had a high school diploma, or even if you didn't, you had a job. You had a chance to become a middle-income household. Today, that's almost impossible, and that's become because technology has changed in such a way as to enormously benefit highly skilled individuals. And we now have a global economy in which the least skilled individuals in our economy are now not competing just against each other, but against low-skilled workers from China and India and Brazil and Indonesia and Vietnam. So those are really the two big changes relative to what Johnson faced. And it's not that some individuals become incredibly wealthy, which is why, you know, the poor are very poor and don't have opportunities. Rather, we live in a world that's made it very difficult to become self-sufficient if you don't have the sufficient skills.
Julian, what about the change in inequality over time? Are you ready to chalk it all up to the super wizardry of those at the top and the educational failings of those at the bottom, and just the change itself and its impact on this picture?
Well, I think, you know, the big point here is that the changes in the economy in the 70s and 80s, I think this is correct, undermined some of what the war on poverty, broadly defined, aimed to do. Loss of good jobs, the loss of a path to the middle class, or that becoming more difficult, made it that much harder for people to get out of poverty. And to have a strong social safety net was integral to protecting people from falling down lower. But economic policies and private market changes didn't help. And they created a situation where it was very hard for people to gain entry into the kind of jobs that in the 40s and 50s really dampened the number of people who were living in poverty, and the situation was already bad. So the 70s really hurt it. The rise of inequality since that decade, which is a result of government policy, it's a result of changes in the market, have you know, really eroded a lot of Lyndon Johnson's programs in that respect.
Of course, there was a time in the 1990s when President Clinton was looking for that third way, the middle way, and very into welfare reform. Here was President Clinton, August 1996.
It gives us a chance we haven't had before to break the cycle of dependency that has existed for millions and millions of our fellow citizens, exiling them from the world of work that gives structure, meaning, and dignity to most of our lives.
President Clinton signing the Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Reconciliation Act of 1996. Melissa, where are we collectively and individually, the balance here of responsibility? And what about inequality in your view, its effect on our poverty rate?
According to research from the Economic Policy Institute, inequality is the top contributor to our growing poverty rate. It contributed 6 percentage points from the 60s until today.
Why? How's that work? Explain that.
Well, I mean, some of the things were already mentioned. You know, you had technology, globalization, driving down wages. You had weakened unions and labor market institutions. But I don't think that any of those things are inevitable. I think that we also made policy choices that exacerbated the situation. So, for example, we've allowed our minimum wage to decline by 30% since the 1960s in real dollars. We have disinvested from skills training. And for example, in the 1960s to today, the cost of a public university when you add tuition fees, room and board has more than doubled. And so at the exact same time that people need to be accessing a college education in order to enter the middle class and some of these medium to high skilled jobs, it's increasingly unaffordable. These are policy choices in addition to outside trends. And one of the arguments we're really making is that we need to update our policy framework and our institutions to build on what's been successful over the past 50 years, but to acknowledge these changes and to make sure that we're providing that same pathway to the middle class that people had.
So start to move into some of that new thinking. You want to cut poverty in half in 10 years? That would get it into single digits. We just got a minute before the break, but where would you begin?
So we put out a study in 2007 that showed that this was not rocket science or some Pollyannish pie-in-the-sky goal, that if you did three basic things, you could get more than halfway to the goal. Raising the minimum wage to its historic level of half the average wage, expanding tax credits for low-wage working families, per Lee's point, and then secondly, making childcare fully available as a work support for those families who qualify to address some of those barriers to work. Those three things alone would have cut poverty in half by 26% over the 10 years. So we can do this.
Lee, would you sign on to those three?
No, those are a number of good ideas. At the end of the day, an individual has to have the skills available to compete in today's economy, and those changes will help. It won't do everything. We can provide child care, we provide tax credits, but at the end of the day, a person needs to be able to earn a paycheck that's sufficient to be able to provide for their family. That'll help, but it's not the whole story.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about poverty in America and tackling it 50 years after LBJ declared war on poverty. This is interesting. Republican Senator Mike Lee of Utah, in September last year, talking with the American Enterprise Institute, conservative think tank on what he called, Republican senator, the inequality crisis in America, he bemoaned the economic and social detachment, he said, of the elite, the upper class.
At the top of society, we find a political and economic elite that, having reached the highest rungs, have pulled the ladder up behind itself, denying others the chance even to climb. From Wall Street to K Street to Pennsylvania Avenue, we find special interests increasingly exempted and insulated by law from the rigors of competition and from the consequences of their own mistakes.
Republican Senator Mike Lee going after a political and economic elite, but of course in another speech he said that 1964 wasn't the year Americans started fighting poverty, it's the year we started losing that fight. He's talking about obstructions from government programs, but inequality acknowledged there as an issue in this country in a big way right now. Mike in Buffalo, New York. Mike, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yes. One of the things I thought was sad about the war on poverty was Johnson had set up the Model Cities program where he was going to experiment to find out what would really work if we really hit the cities with everything we had. And they picked eight cities originally, then they called it the Demonstration Cities Act, but they had to change the name because of the word demonstration.
Yeah.
And Model Cities program started with 8, but then they had to expand it to at least have one program in each 50 states. So that watered down a lot of what they wanted to do in terms of the experiments. Half of that money was impounded and dumped on Cambodia and Vietnam as well.
Yeah, that was an issue then and now, the cost of wars abroad. Julian Zelizer, what about Johnson and funding? I mean, he had just signed a tax cut when he called for the war on poverty. He said he would not increase taxes. Did he want to put more into it, or did he want limits on it?
He was always constrained politically, so the first answer is that from the start, when he calls for a war on poverty, he only asked for about $500 million for the Economic Opportunity Act, which was not a lot. He had just gotten a tax cut through Congress. He didn't feel that he could get much revenue from the tax guardians, and he was always going to fight this on the cheap, and part of that was just political pragmatism. The Model Cities program is absolutely correct. Initially, it started as an idea to have an influx of money to a few cities who had bold ideas about how to really change the infrastructure, the kinds of issues we've been talking about. But to get it through Congress, he basically had to offer more cities the opportunities to compete for this money. And so more places got money, but they got very little money. And the program was very ineffective. So the politics of passing this didn't work in the favor of Model Cities. And ultimately, Vietnam was extraordinarily damaging. It was his own war that increased the pressures by 1967 and 68 to have a tax increase. And the deal to get a tax increase through Congress was cuts in domestic discretionary spending, which put a halt on a lot of what he had done. So funding and politics was a big part of why the war on poverty was in many ways more limited than he had hoped it would be.
So here we are, 2014, and Melissa, President Obama, I'm looking at a Wire story coming out here saying this week he'll announce 5 what they're calling promise zones with special tax incentives and grants to help communities tackle poverty. These will be in San Antonio, Texas, Philadelphia, Los Angeles, Southeast Kentucky, and in the Choctaw Nation in Oklahoma. What about that kind of targeted effort now, Melissa, 50 years later?
I think it's critically important that we complement federal efforts with these kinds of infusions into local neighborhoods and governments so that they can experiment, they can lift up what works, and they can also break down local silos. You can figure out how you can integrate schools and communities and businesses and bring everybody together across different silos to work together to address local problems. I don't think that's a replacement for our federal social safety net or macroeconomic policies to grow the economy and grow jobs, but I think it's a critical complement.
Robert in Burlington, Vermont. Robert, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi. So probably I agree. The only real disappointment we had with LBJ is that he wasn't JFK, and then Vietnam became the burden over his neck and the resulting social upheaval. What happened is the Democratic Party fought this war on poverty for about 15 years, and then Ronald Reagan happened. And over the 80s, it just became bad politics to advocate openly for the poor. The Great Society essentially went into the trash can. And this became obvious to me since the candidacy and presidency of Bill Clinton, who would not advocate openly for the poor, was like his middle-class Bill of Rights, not one for the poor. It wasn't like a living wage. It wasn't like, anyway. Since then, it was just impossible for Democratic politicians to openly advocate for the poor because they wouldn't get elected as a result. And so one reason why here in Vermont we have a viable third party is because some of us got a little bit tired of voting for one Republican candidate for office and another Republican candidate for office. We needed some other party, some other organized people to openly advocate for the needs of the poor, for a living wage, single payer, for child care, for the just the practical, real things that we really need to do to really address poverty in this country, which it seems like the people in Europe have, in industrialized countries in Europe, have figured out reasonably well.
Robert, I hear that, and yet Europe's having all kinds of economic problems itself built on that model. They've had unemployment through the roof in some of those countries, and still. So what about economically? I mean, I hear the government supports you want to have there, and I understand the arguments for them. How do you make the economy really produce for everybody at the same time, Robert?
You pay people what they're worth, and if if a job needs to be done, even if it's, you know, no matter how humble the job is, if it needs to be done, if it needs to be done by an adult, then that person deserves to get paid enough that they can actually live on it and actually spend.
Lee, what about it? I mean, we can talk globalization till the cows come home, and it's a fact and it's out there, but it's undercut incomes in this country in many ways. The promise was the opposite, that free trade would make this economic boom, and yet we see low wages all over the place. Do we need a whole new way of thinking about how to put both jobs and livable wages in people's pockets, in their lives?
Well, you know, the only way we're going to get low-skilled people hired is either hired at wage levels that that the caller's talking about is one of two ways. Either we have to improve their skill levels so that it's profitable for a business to hire them at those levels, or we have to subsidize their employment. We have to pay employers to hire these people, because otherwise they'll make a loss. Those are really the only two ways.
I mean, those sound crazy in old terms, but in 2014, you look around and you wonder if there are going to be enough paying jobs, even if we got educations up. I mean, look at Switzerland. They do a pretty good job of educating their people, and they've just had this vote on guaranteeing everybody, what, like a $30,000 a year income? Everybody in the country. It seems like the Swiss... Now, they haven't gone for it, but it's a serious proposal out there saying we're not sure the economy produces anymore, Lee.
Yeah, well, you know, there's just no way, you know, we or any other country can make that type of promise and pull it off. I mean, you're right. We now, the real danger we have in this country is that we have an economy today in 2014 that's underperforming compared to what it achieved in the past. And when we go back and look at Clinton's signing of the welfare to work transition programs, poverty fell at that time. And many people say, gee, that's because of the program that Clinton signed. And that may have been part of it, but the big part is that our economy performed very, very well in creating opportunities for low-skill workers. We don't have that same level of economic vibrancy today, and it's not just a consequence of the recession we just went through, or the fact we had a financial crisis a few years ago. If you compare the 80s and 90s to what I would call the good Bush years, 02 to 07, we have much less entrepreneurship, we have less investment, we have less job creation. All the usual metrics of long-run economic growth are much, much worse today than
before. But we know what happened at the end of those Bush years. That was rough on everybody. Keith in Wakefield, Rhode Island. Keith, thanks for calling. You're on.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm enjoying the conversation and learning a lot, but I'm continuing to hear this conversation, and it seems like there's a big part that never gets spoken about, and that's families having children that they can't afford. And I don't think it's a female issue. I think it's a human issue. I think it's an economic issue that children cost money, and if you don't have a job that can support a family – why are people engaging in having families? My wife and I, both educated, waited carefully until we had a financial situation that we could afford a family. And I feel like that subject is taboo, and it seems to be a big white elephant in the middle of the room.
Well, Keith, let's pick it right up, though. I understand what you're saying. Be responsible. Wait till you've got the income and all the rest. On the other hand, we've got 47 million people in this country in poverty. Now, if they can't get decent-paying jobs that will support a family, what are you telling them? 47 million people, or whatever the adult portion of that is, you don't deserve to have a family? I mean, you only live once, right?
No, I'm not suggesting they don't.
Well, what are they supposed to do? If they wait and wait, and the circumstances never come around, they're in poverty, that's okay for that big chunk of Americans just to say, nope, all of those joys, all of that living is not for you?
No. Not at all. That's not what I'm suggesting.
Okay.
What I'm suggesting is parenthood should be a choice, not an accident.
And point taken. But I think that my rejoinder stands there as well. If they can't get on the ladder, what are we suggesting for them? But I appreciate your call, Keith. Chris in Nashville, Tennessee. Chris, you're on.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Okay. What do you see?
I was actually having this conversation with a couple of people just 2 days ago, and I said, you know, and everybody was, you know, well off and white and male. And I said, look, we need to step out of whitewashed county for a second and look at it from a different perspective. You've got to realize that there are multiple perspectives. I know people who have grown up in poverty and they've made their way out, but it was
sure.
tough. You know, they had all these people around them telling them they couldn't do it. And once you get in, once you get out, you have a perspective of both. But my problem is that we were talking about companies and how companies aren't paying the wages that they should be paying to people. And the people I was talking to said that simply that, that companies, these people should not spend the rest of their lives in these jobs like McDonald's or things like that. They should be trying to work up to better jobs. And I said, look, we need these people. These people need to live as well. And if you don't give them the wages they need to survive, they're just simply not going to – they're going to continue to live on the cycle of dependence, and which is a subject you brought up before.
Yeah. Yeah, it sounds like you didn't get much of a hearing for that. I take your point, Melissa. On that point, Lee says, yes, but if you don't ultimately have the skills, you can't really be an earning, factor in the global economy. And yeah, we can subsidize, we can raise minimum wages, it would help at the margins, but it's not a real answer, Melissa.
Look, 40% of job growth last year happened in sectors that traditionally pay lower wages, retail, fast food, healthcare, education, et cetera. And so these low-wage jobs are here to stay unless we take steps to improve job quality. I agree with Lee that it's important to improve skill levels, to increase the share of high and medium-skilled jobs that pay good wages. But at the end of the day, the people who care for our aging parents, the people who care for our children, the people who clean our offices, those jobs are necessary in our economy, and they're here to stay. And I think one of the critical parts of cutting poverty is going to be to figure out how we improve the quality of those jobs. And again, it's not rocket science. We can raise the minimum wage to its historic level of half the average wage. We can enact paid sick days legislation so that low-wage workers are not forced to choose between whether or not to care for their sick kid or to lose a week's of pay or even be fired. So these are just simple steps we could take to improve the quality of these jobs.
One more call. Barbara in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Barbara, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have some comments as to how I think the situation can improve.
Okay.
But I do have a question I want to ask. And I've worked in OEO. When did the idea ever happen that people thought they could support a family on a minimum wage? This is something I keep hearing that never existed as I was growing.
Yeah, I know what you mean. On the other hand, people didn't think they were going to be stuck at minimum wage either, did they?
They didn't, but I think we have to get rid of this myth, because if people
yep.
believe they can do it, this is not going to happen. All right, here's my suggestion.
Yep.
You ask why Europe has answered some questions. First of all, we still don't have health care for everybody, national health care. That's a given. You've got to have it. People who are poor are often poor because they can't pay their medical bills or have access to the system. And they keep changing who consists of the poor. You ask, and then I think also, we have to have education that's affordable. I'm actually going to say I want almost all post-secondary education to be almost free. I know it sounds crazy. Remember when California was doing it. But you're creating more poor people, the working poor, and these people who come out with $40,000 worth of debts, and then they can't get a job or one that pays for the debts. So I want more education available and the job training. And we have tons of housing that needs to be created that's affordable for low-income people and affordable.
Barbara, let me take it right there. Our time grows short. You got a great list, Julian Zelizer. Is this a country that can still rise to that kind of ambition? Or can we live with this level of poverty? Will we just take this as our reality and on we go? Is that sustainable?
Well, given that we can barely pass a budget, you would have to at least now conclude that we're not going to tackle what is a very big issue. I think all the proposals are fair from both, left and right have a lot of ideas about what to do, but we are right now in a polarized political system that is unable to really function. And so the idea that right now government would launch a new agenda and really try to deal with the multiple parts of the poverty problem, I don't think we're there right now. I think we're going to need some kind of sea change through an election, through grassroots activism that puts pressure on politicians to do this. Otherwise, we're not on the cusp of a new great society.
History does not stop. Effort to make a better society, certainly to keep it from drifting down, That's never not required. I don't think we can just stick right here. I appreciate the ideas from all over the range today. Leo Hanyon at UCLA and the Hoover Institution. Lee, thank you for joining us today from Santa Barbara.
Thank you.
Melissa Boteag at the Center for American Progress. Half in 10, the campaign to cut poverty in half in 10 years is hers. Melissa, good luck with that. We'll be watching.
Thank you.
And Julian Zelizer at Princeton, thank you very much for being here, Julian.
Thank you.
Listeners, thank you for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.